Hey there, welcome to the Cause and Effect podcast. I'm going to pause for just a second here because, yes, we changed the name of the podcast from Faces of Marketing to Cause and Effect, which is all about affecting positive change in our community here in Oregon and beyond. So, yes, the Cause and Effect, affect with an A, podcast is where we talk about the human stories and lives of entrepreneurs and change makers here in Oregon. This is your host, Ryan Buchanan, and I'm here with my good friend, Tyrone Poole, who is founder of OneApp and also my favorite TEDx Portland speaker of all time. And I don't say that often, but welcome to the show, Tyrone.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So I'm going to set the stage a little bit. Tyrone, you and I got to know each other through a mutual entrepreneur friend, Pat Cassie, and also through the largest foundation in the state of Oregon, as well as one of the largest in the country, called Oregon Community Foundation, where you were right about to do a keynote presentation for them. And it was right at a critical time in your company. And this was just a couple months ago. So we're going to hear about that now. But yeah, your company, OneApp, it's fascinating what you were describing as you were kind of transforming it from a free rental application website to a mobile app to be the only app that can be used to stay in compliance with Portland, Oregon, and Minnesota's new fair housing laws that you helped to shape. And I'm sure there's a whole backstory there that we'll learn about. But basically overnight, because these laws go into effect in like March, you have to build a highly scalable team to build this, you know, big software product add-on to your existing tool. And you've got to negotiate with elected officials and landlords, get investors, raise five young girls, be a good husband, and keep from losing your mind all at the same time. So how do you do all of that? Let's pick whatever you want to start with, and we'll go from there.
So to be honest, you can't do them all well. So somebody's dropping the ball. Somebody's getting the short end of the stick. Unfortunately, during some of the really tough times, my wife gets the short end of the stick. She knows the game by now, though. Like, when I'm in the trenches and I'm not social and I'm in my head, even when I'm at home, because I'm trying to be present, but it's impossible. Just too many things on the plate. I was just telling you how right after Thanksgiving, the next morning, I took my daughters to Black Friday and then dropped them off at 11 and was at the office. And then I was there Saturday and I was there Sunday.
And your wife works with you too, right?
She does. She used to be in the office, but now she is more of my like executive assistant from home type stuff. Yeah, she actually was at the office with the girls decorating it on Sunday. So we put a Christmas tree up, some gifts for the staff. We had fun. So I was able to work and be with the girls. So she's learned. So but, you know, a lot of anxiety comes from when you have a plate that full. And so you just got to have the right, I mean, you got to have an amazing wife, first of all, or you won't be successful. And you got to have a team that has some leaders in it that can understand what is called upon us right now and pick up a lot of the slack, which I have a couple good pieces of like that. And then I got to collect some more. And you got to have a good investment group that that can see your vision and make sure that you have the capital you need to get through some of these rough patches. So, yeah, I mean, it's a team effort. That's the one word right there. Team is the only way to pull off that kind of stuff.
I like it. So speaking of team, five girls, you've got a basketball team right there.
I do. Starting five.
Now, are they into sport? What kind of stuff are they into?
Oh, so they're all unique, right? So my oldest is a bookworm. She is just an all-out nerd. She's beautiful. I love her that she just stays in her room and reads. She's antisocial as it comes. I have to drag her down to spend time with Thanksgiving with family. Like, it's she's just too cool and too, she's reached the age where like social is not hip for her anymore. My 11-year-old is a gymnast. She was first in state and then second in state over the last 2 years. She's a rock star at the MAC. She is actually going to be leaving the MAC to do privates. So she's getting
That's
even more expensive.
Legit.
Yeah, she's she's to the point now where like the social gymnastics is holds her back.
And how old is she?
11. She started when she was 4, and she is just unstoppable. And she is a huge time consumer of all those meets, all of those events.
5 a.m. like, yes. Yeah.
Drop off and pickups. And she is. So then I got, you know, I have a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old. And those are back-to-back children. They are just becoming into their own personalities, but their personalities are literally like reverse. My 3, almost 4-year-old, she is to the point where she won't do anything for herself. Like she goes to the bathroom and won't even pull her own pants up. Seriously. She will walk out and be like, help me pull my pants up. I'm like, I'm not helping you pull your pants up. And she will sit there crying until you help her.
Well, her older sisters can help too, right?
Yeah, they can, but you know, my oldest won't do anything to help anybody. My 11-year-old is the most helpful, but she's gone all the time, right? So my 7-year-old, she is my mama's girl. She's the one at home all the time. She is she's the biggest helper. She's at that age where she's too disconnected from the older two, and she's too old for the babies. So she's like the middle child that just sits with mom all day and always wants to be with either me or her. And then, like I said, my younger two, my 4-year-old is picking up this like helpless mentality, while my 2-year-old won't let you help her with a thing. I can't even buckle her into the car seat. I have to fight with
her.
That's
the no age, right? Everything's no.
Everything is no. I tried to cut her waffle this morning into pieces. Oh, she had to do it herself. And things that are like 2 seconds take like 10 minutes, right? So, but that's all 5 of my girls. They are their own individual people. That's the one amazing thing about kids. Like, you never know what they're going to turn into. Like, but their personalities come in overnight, it feels like. And then they're who
they
are.
So different. Yeah, I have 2 daughters, and yes, they couldn't be more different. It's crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we're shifting in and out of personal and business stuff, but going back to your TEDx talk that I was so enamored by, that I saw a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. Why do you want to just tell? You've told this. You give a lot of speeches and all of that stuff, so I'm sure you've told this story hundreds and hundreds of times. But it really is kind of the origin story of how 1UP started. Mm-hmm. So just kind of set the stage for us.
Yeah, I mean, I went to school to be a fireman. I own a tech company, 1UP. We haven't got into it yet, but that's where I am today. And I had no intentions of being a business owner or in technology. I got injured during my fireman training. I had already got my EMT and my paramedic from Portland State University, or from Portland Community College. And then I got my associate's in fire science. And I applied for the academy and got injured really bad and ended up being hospitalized for 9 months. So 9 months with my leg elevated above my heart, 16 out of 24 hours a day. It was a very long time, and then I did a lot of rehab at the Rebound Clinic, right next to the Blazers. Yeah. Or the
Moda Center,
yeah. And I saw a couple Blazers during my long rehab stint because they use the same facility. Mm-hmm. It took me a year from the time I got out of the hospital before I was allowed to work a job. So I literally was banned from work from doctors. So and then when I was released, I could only do 4 hours a day in a maximum of 20 hours a week. So when I was able to work, I still couldn't get meaningful work because I couldn't make a livable wage still. So it was a long
Now you work process. 20 hours a day, right?
Exactly.
7 days a week. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm making up for lost time. And during that process of being in the hospital, I lost my apartment, was evicted because I didn't pay my rent. My family worked hard to help me put everything in a storage unit. And I remember I'm the oldest of 8 children. So my mom and aunt helped put my stuff in a storage unit, and they paid. It was like first month free, I think it was, or maybe 2 months free. Mm-hmm. But third month, they ended up repossessing my storage unit. And so I lost all my baby pictures. I lost all my everything I owned was pretty much moved into that storage unit. So
they didn't let you get it out of there?
No, that's the thing about storage unit. Like, I was literally like, you know, I need to come get it out. And they're like, you can get it out when you pay for it. And if you don't pay, then they end up auctioning all your stuff off. They literally sell your storage unit to highest bidder who comes in and gets all of your stuff because you didn't pay for it. So it was my couch. It was my everything, my video games, everything I had in a storage unit was gone. My car was repossessed. I mean, they actually repoed it from the parking lot at the hospital right there. I always talk about how my credit got so destroyed, but I literally had things going on my credit report while I was still in the hospital. So credit, hospital bills that went unpaid were hitting my credit, and I'm still in the hospital. It was a very brutal time. So what's funny is that even after I got my settlement, I was able to pay all my medical off, and I thought that my credit would get boosted up. It does not.
Over time, right?
I mean, I paid off $50,000 in medical bills, and I was like, I'm going to have like a 750 credit score. It did virtually nothing. It just said settled, like all of these, and still no boost, though. It takes years from that to get back on track. But during that process, I ended up couch hopping with a bunch of buddies when I first got out of the hospital after 9 months. It was the happiest day ever. I was finally free from that prison of a hospital, and ended up couch hopping with, you know, first with my immediate family, and then that ended up moving to friends and buddies from high school. And then about 90 days after being released from the hospital, I had already overstayed all welcomes from every person I had known in my circle. And then I ended up moving into the YMCA homeless shelter. And that was a low. I remember moving into that shelter. I had 3 garbage bags full of stuff. And it was literally everything I owned in the entire world. And 1 year ago, I was like my own apartment. I was graduated 4th out of 72 of my class at PCC. I got accepted into the academy on my very first attempt with 600 or so applicants, with such a huge pool. Mm-hmm. And a year later, I'm on a cot in the YWCA Goose Hollow shelter. So such a crazy.
And you, I think I remember you telling the story one time where you were telling the woman who was running it, like, oh, I'm not going to be here. Oh. You know, like, this isn't me, you know.
Yes. That first morning after I woke up in the shelter, it's funny because you have this perception of what people who live in shelters are like, right? You're like, these people are not who I am. And remember, I didn't get into the shelter till maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. So they turned the lights on. People were like, what's going on? Because lights don't come on until 7 a.m.
And she made an exception for you, right?
She did, I was not supposed to. That's not how you. There's a process to get into a shelter. I did not meet that. I didn't follow any of the steps. I literally had a police officer drive me there and drop me off at the shelter. I didn't get to see any of the people there. They let me in, set me up with a cot, turn the lights back off, asked me to be quiet while I like had my bags and stuff settled. And I didn't take any clothes off. I slept with a coat. I mean, I was laid right there. Just my coat, probably the only thing I took off, but that was it. And that next morning, I tried to dart out of that shelter. I was like, I don't want anybody to see me. Like, I don't know how I even got to this point. I had cried that night for the very first time since this whole thing happened, because I'm such a high-spirited person. I was like, this will all work out. And then that was that night. I was like, this is not working out. Like, I don't know what's going on, but this is got into a low that is like beyond even my ability to just digest right now. So I ended up trying to get out of there, and Dale came back to me, and she just persuaded me to come and do an intake. I lived in the shelter for 3 months. I lived with the YWCA. And during that process, I don't talk about this very much, but it was eye opening. Like, I was completely wrong about who lives in shelters. I mean, I know people think it's like the winos or the people who have mental disability, and that makes up a percentage. But I mean, out of 100 people, I'd say 5. And even the people who are there don't want to be around those people because they smell or they're not taking care of themselves. But the majority of people are like, I mean, there were people in there for every reason you could think of. Domestic violence. It was a woman, a couple that every time the door slammed, she jumped because she didn't know who was coming through that door because she was afraid of her situation. There was these two boys who got in a fight at their school, got kicked off campus, had nowhere to go, end up both coming into the Y and then becoming best friends until they found a place.
Wait, how old were these boys?
They were probably, oh man, maybe 19, 20, but they got in a fight. They went to school at, I believe, Portland State University. Mm-hmm. Both got kicked off and had to go somewhere. Ended up going into this shelter that was somebody, one of the people from the school told them, we'll get you set up in here, but you can't be on campus until this whole thing gets sorted out. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up, when they finally got a chance to speak to the board to get back on campus, they spoke as best friends, saying like, let us back into
school. We were
school.
Mortal enemies, now we're best friends.
Yes, I mean, just the scenarios of people who are in there. I mean, it was, you know, families that were laid off from work. It was, I honest to God, as bad as my situation were, there were people in there that I would not have traded places with. Like, I didn't have babies that I was worried about. I didn't have a lot of the stuff that would have made it unbearable, even more so. And so so I was completely changed. I remember my favorite term was Amazing Grace, because I was blind and then I could see. And that was my whole experience with being in shelter. So it will completely live in a shelter for 3-4 days, and it will change your perception of what homeless is. I mean, we were at Applebee's trying to shut the place down because we didn't want to go back and eat spaghetti and noodles back at the Y. Our hot dogs and spaghetti at the Y again. So we were like eating appetizers with like pennies. I mean, we got close. A lot of people did. And then when somebody gets housed, you're like so happy for them. But when you're still in the shelter, it's depressing, right?
Yeah. And part of your story was, to the audience, you're saying like, you know, family members are supportive and friends are supportive, but then they reach a point and, you know, that point, like, you're like, and I'm likable. And for most people, it's 30 days. You lasted like 90 days or something like that.
Yeah. 3 months.
Yeah.
Before I had to end up at the Y. And that, it's so true, because when I first got the shelter, the hospital, I can't tell you how many people were supporting me. Like, I mean, I had, when I finally got released, because I had a reputation of being a hard worker, like, you know, from my church, from family, from school. I even had my instructor that I was training under when I got hurt, came and visited me and said, helped me anything that I could do. Like, it was so much support when I first got out. That I could pick and choose where I wanted to stay. People gave me anything I needed. Oh man, I got these Jordans. I don't even wear them. You can have them. You know, you need a place to do laundry, come over. You know, like anything you got, you need, I got you. And you literally go from that to trying to be invisible. It's like a skill. You learn to show up at people's house at 11 p.m. and wake up and be out by before they wake up in the morning, trying to leave like the smallest footprint possible so that you can stay somewhere as long as before they, like, because, you know, you will burn them out, and you start to learn that you are needy. You got crutches, you got bags, you got stuff that blocks people's living rooms and they don't want it sitting around there. And you have to elevate your legs when you come home, so you need to put them up on the couch, and you got to, you know, you have a footprint, and you learn to try to be invisible, right? And so, 90 days, and I always consider that best case, because I'm like, you couldn't have been better, you know, than the rep that I had when I first got in there. And so that's why I do joke about, I'm like, a lot of people think, well, 90 days is a long, no, that was best case.
I know.
You might have 2 weeks.
I know. So that kind of gave you the light bulb that went off in your head of like, man, I am struggling so much to find a place. Mm-hmm. Well, because then you started looking for housing and you had government assistance, and yes, even when the dollars weren't a problem, it was your credit that became a problem, but you wouldn't know what the reason was why you wouldn't get into a place, right?
That's exactly right. You know, I the second day at the YMCA, so I met with Dale, the director of the Y at that time, and I was given an award letter the following day, So I met with her. She said, I'm going to get you, you know, you qualify for us to pay your rent for a year. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And I was so happy. And I mean, we hugged, we did everything. And she was like, okay, go to this day shelter, hang out there, shower, do laundry, do whatever you need to do. And then I'll see you back here this afternoon and I'll have your award letter. And so I was back on time and I, you know, she had this printed document for me. I was able to take it anywhere and she was going to pay my rent up to a certain dollar amount. And I, in my mind, was going to be in an apartment before the end of the week. Because money was the only barrier that I would assume that I would have. And 3 months, I was applying to properties. Denied.
Three months.
So it was 60 days in the shelter, and then you can get a 30-day extension. And I ended up qualifying for a 30-day extension because of my disability. I couldn't walk for very long periods of time. So I applied, and they gave me an additional 30 days to be in the shelter. At the end of that extension, I found a place that would rent to me. I mean, and when I tell that story, a lot of people were like, man, you must have spent so much money and had to go around this. You know, I was on the bus to Vancouver because there were rumors of places that approved people that would outdo
And you had
stuff.
To pay 25 oh, 50, bucks, 50 bucks for you know, the application fee every time.
Every single time. And I don't know how much money I borrowed and begged. But the hardest memories from that is, no exaggeration, a good month of the time that I was in that shelter was the hardest because I wasn't applying to properties anymore.
Because you gave up.
Yeah. I was so beat down that I would literally wake up and go to the day shelter and then go to the night shelter and then go to the day.
Because you didn't know why you were being turned down. Just like a general, oh, credit.
Depends on the property. I mean, they would just say you're denied. And then if you want to know why, you'd have to like you have to request it in writing and to the screening company via mail. And then they would mail you. But you don't have no address, so you can't really be getting mail places. And when you ask them at the property, because you want to fix it, you're like, what is it? Like, tell me what it is that's blocking me. I'll overcome it right now. Just tell me what it is. And there was no answers. No one could tell you what the issue was. It was just this this ambiguous process that you just get denied, and that's just the end of it. Like, you just they just want you to move on, like, because they got to get the next applicant. It's a business, right? And so, and to be honest, there's no revenue to be made by expending, you know, cost and energy to try to educate people on what the issues were. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just not part of the business model. Mm-hmm. I eventually got approved to a place that was 6 blocks from the shelter. I went, like, no exaggeration, hour and a half bus rides from the MAX to the bus to C-Tran out in Vancouver. And I don't even know how I was going to live out there. But it was like, I don't care. This place approves people. 6 blocks, just they're just hiding in plain sight. There's no way to know they're right there. And I go apply to this place. And the only reason I even saw it is because, so I used to hop on the MAX, but I didn't have fare. So I would just, whenever a fare inspector came on, I would just hop off and try to, like, just leave. Because they would
game the system.
Exactly. Yeah. And wherever I get off at, I'm just stuck, right? So in this chance, I got off the stop before Goose Hollow stop. So it was right before. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to walk these back streets, these 6 blocks of the shelter. And I saw a lady putting the yard sign in the front yard. And I asked her to do a tour and walk through it. And I had applied to some dumps. And this one was nice. It was a 2-story. It was 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. It was a really nice apartment. And I had $25 application fee. She told me, oh, I work with the Y all the time, you know. And I went there and I paid the $25, and I waited the next day. And she called me and just said, you're approved. And I'm telling you, it was the most unbelievable
feeling.
That's
like spiritual right there. You know, like that, that just doesn't happen every day.
It doesn't. And I am I believe in God. So I always tell myself, like, the odds of me having to hop off the MAX because I didn't have fare at that stop, like there was, and then walk that direction, like that path, because I didn't walk the MAX track. Like, I just walked the roads or the blocks at the, And it was just, you know, he was like, all right, you put up with enough now. Let me go ahead and get you an apartment. It was how it happened.
Just make you suffer right to the brink.
Yeah, because I think he needed me to know I need to experience it. Because if I didn't experience it, then I wouldn't have tried to solve it, right?
And you wouldn't have worked 100-plus-hour weeks to just...
Exactly.
Because it's been hard. Every entrepreneur path is hard, but your path is, like, extra hard.
Yeah, because I don't have any of the... I mean, I got set on a path to solve a problem with no education, no resources, no... Like, most people who solve a problem or go after it, they prepared themselves for that problem. You know what I mean? I didn't go to college to be a social worker and then... You know, I didn't have any of the skill sets. All I had was my experience, right? Mm-hmm. And that was enough to drive me.
Your story. Everybody's got a powerful story, but your story is especially good because it's so painful.
It is. It is. So I ended up, that lady, she approved me. And my first question was, you know, why in the world did you approve me? Like, when I met her in person, mm-hmm. I asked her directly, like, I know you must have saw everything everybody else saw. You know, and I was honestly asking because there were people at the shelter that I was going to refer to. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, what is it about? Because those people who had horrible criminal histories and I went and applied and they denied me, but they approved them. And I'm like, man, what is it about me that is it? And then I learned that that property just was a felony friendly property, but they were not an eviction friendly property, which was one of my issues, right? They were not a credit friendly. And I didn't know anything about screening criteria. And what she said is literally why I built that website. She said, you know, sweetie, I don't know what you're talking about. You just met our screening criteria. And that was it. And I was like, can you let me know can you give me a copy of it? And she gave me a copy of it. And I like went through it and learned so much about it and learned that, you know, they don't take more than 5 accounts and collections. And I'm like, well, I got way more than that. And then it's like, but we don't consider Medicore a student. And I'm like, well, if you take all these medical things off and the student debt, then it was less than 5 accounts. I mean, it was like, we don't take evictions within 1 year, but they do if you pay a double deposit, right? Which most places just do not take evictions within 1 year. I mean, it was just, I went through it and realized that out of this page and a half screening criteria, I just fit. And I became a screening criteria junkie. I literally, at one point in time, I probably had 40 company screening criteria on my desk at the YMCA or YWCA.
You became like a lawyer, like all the details, the stuff that everybody hates reading. Yes, you're into it.
Yeah. I was, because I was, and I still became like a data fiend as an adult now, but it was because people would come in and I'd be like, did they tell you anything about why they denied you? Because if I just knew anything, I could be like, my brain used to hold it all in. Like, I'd be like, oh, wait, you had an eviction? Don't even waste your time going here, 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 right? Because those guys don't take them. I know for a fact. I have their criteria sitting on my desk, right? And I just started to learn it. And it got to the point to where I would see somebody that would come in and I would talk to them. And within minutes, I'd be like, I'm going to give you this award letter. So let me back up. I actually started working for the YWCA. I worked there for a couple years. And I was on the other side of the table giving out award letters. So now people come in, I hear their story, I give them an award letter. And I literally would talk to them for 15 minutes and I would know definitively if they would find housing or not when I gave them this letter. I'm paying your rent for a year and I'm positive you're never going to find a place, or you should be good. You won't need much help.
So you thought, okay, I'm either going to start an app company or just give everyone my mobile number, because you were like a personal app.
I was.
In Tyrone Pool.
I was. I got so good at housing people. So I don't talk about this much either, but I was asked once, what was the exact spark that triggered you to build this business? And I had the passion for it because I experienced it, but the spark was Dale Davis, the director of the Y at that time. She talked to the newspaper about this kid who went through this whole experience, and now he's working here and he is by far the number one most loved, most like effective housing coordinator, like a family advocate. And it was me. And the newspaper came out and did an article on me. And my mom still has it hanging up in her office right now. And it was the scanner. And I was, I'm telling you, so the shelter had a, I didn't own an iron. So the shelter had one. And I remember going in there and ironing my jeans, ironing my clothes, and like making myself, I felt like I borrowed some stuff. Like I looked so good for this interview, right? And I had this button up and it was ironed, and I had some nice pants, and they came out and they did this interview with me. And it was the first time I really had ever told my story to the public. And the scanner did this article, and it was like, went to school to be a hero and ended up being a hero in other ways, right? And it was like the coolest article. My mom hung it up, and that is when I was like, well, I'm going to solve this problem, because I was like, I'm good at something, because I was supposed to be a fireman. And I was good at it. And then after that was taken from me, I wasn't good at anything. You know what I mean? Like, that was my whole...
That's how you felt.
Yes, that's how I felt. And then I was like, this I'm good at, and I'm going to solve this. And that was my whole... Like, that was the spark. I remember being getting the Entrepreneur of the Year Award.
Through OEN?
Yeah, through OEN. Okay. And I remember right before I left there... to go to that award, I was at my mom's house, and I read the article. Again, I hadn't read in forever, that she still keeps. And I felt like I was 10 feet tall and looked like $1 million when I took it, right? And looking at it now, my T-shirt was stretched out, so my neckline was way deep. And the button-up that I had over the T-shirt, like the T-shirt was under, then the button-up, right? And it was too big. Like, it was tucked into my pants with, like, these huge bowls between
everything's relative, you know? Like, you were 10 feet tall given what you had just been through. But now that you're on a much bigger stage, your expectations are higher for yourself.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so I looked at it. And that's why when I was on the OEN, right when I got on stage, I had looked at myself in the mirror and I had just got a real suit, like a real one. And that's all I can say is I was like, I look good in this suit. Much better than I looked in the suit that I had when I first got this bug. But yeah, I collected criteria, and then I built an app that literally holds the screening criteria of 309 of the 389 licensed management companies in Oregon. And you can go on my platform as a renter and pull your background check, and it will screen you against every single vacancy that all of those companies have in real time. And it will tell you out of the 4,000 vacancies, you qualify for 215, and here they are. Mm-hmm. Right there. There is no application fees, no losing money, no time. I mean, it is literally the equivalent of spending $200,000 in application fees and going around applying to properties for 11 years. And it is done.
And it's free.
And it's free. Yeah. It's free. It costs you nothing to go figure out where you can get the keys from right now. And it, we launched it. We had 1,700 background checks pulled in the first 30 days. No advertising. We still never had any dollars for advertising. So it's either people are like, I've heard of one app. People are like, how did you hear about it? We've never put a single penny out. And it's all been word of mouth, people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you started the company almost 7 years ago, right?
So
that's what LinkedIn told me.
Yeah. So, so I had to put a date on there of like when, so I basically, the official date the company started is when I won the Startup PDX Challenge. I won it in September. And then I got the money from winning the challenge. And then I also got the support from like Perkins Coie and all those guys. Mm-hmm. And so they helped me form the company. It was an idea before that, right? So January 1st, which was actually January 3rd, but we backdated January 1st of 2015 is when I got my first dollars. I had won the competition the 14th or September of 2014. And they helped me form it, and it existed like it. So if you looked at any papers, like it's going to say the company started January 1st, 2015. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I put that date on my LinkedIn because I was like, I had been working on this like theoretically and in my head for for 2 years before that.
Okay. So you started it, you launched it in the product fully in like 2017.
Mm-hmm.
You got all of these people to come to it. It's being used a ton. There's thousands and thousands of properties on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to this place where basically people are using it in a totally different way than you thought they would. And then you realize I need to change up or add an additional product to make this company really meaningful to the user, right? Because they were applying to properties they knew they wouldn't qualify for.
Yep.
Because the vacancies that they saw there were not in neighborhoods that they wanted to be in, or there was something a little off about it.
Or the property, they just weren't attracted to
it. Yeah, they just weren't attracted to it. And so basically what I understand from what you're doing now and having to build all of these things, and I want to hear about what Portland, the city of Portland did in using your data without telling you about it and things like that. But now really what you're building is the ability for, like, most people who can't get into a place, there it's like 70% of the time, if you as one app co-sign with them, then they'll be able to get into that place. And so that co-signing is a paid service that really makes your whole business model sustainable, because free does not pay the bills. Like, you got seven employees or something, right?
I do.
Pay them. And yeah, you got it. So you're now building a sustainable, financially sustainable business model that really helps people out even more, because if they live in Northeast Portland and the only vacancies are out in Hillsboro, and their whole family and their babysitters and their, you know, all that stuff is all
that
in
community.
Yeah. That whole community is in Northeast Portland. They're never going to, you know, apply out to Hillsboro.
And if they do, they won't be successful living out there. Right. So,
yeah. Because explain that, like, you know, if they have a aunt or a sister or a brother who can take care of their kids while they're working or whatever, there's thousands of dollars that they would have to come out of pocket every month versus
to compensate for what the community was covering.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And we assumed that the reason that people were applying to deny properties, because like you said, people can see on the platform, I'm approved here, yet we still had 30% of our applications going to deny listings, which was frustrating because we built this platform so that people would.
You're like, I already solved your problem. And they're like, no, it's another problem that you need to solve for this now.
Exactly. Because I was positive that if I showed people where they qualified, they would go there. That's not the case. So, that was the issue. Community was a big factor. And we did a survey. We had a bunch of people come. We had a lot of help from SEI. Self-enhancement, they let us use the facility twice, and we did 200 people test, we gave them gifts for showing up, and we had a huge turnout of people who had used our platform, and we just went into depth with them, and the feedback was basically, I can't live at these places, and we're like, you know, what's wrong with living in Beaverton? Have you ever lived out there? What's wrong with it? And it's like, they didn't know how to articulate it, but in reality, they just were saying, I don't know how I would be successful here. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause I have, like you said, I have, you know, right now my kids got to school at 3. I don't get home from off work till 5. So my mom is there to meet the bus. Right. And then she also walks them to the bus in the morning. And you would think, well, you know what the financial value of that is? I mean, an after-school program is probably $200, $300 a month per kid, you know? And then you are sitting there like, okay, well, I might carpool to work, right? With my roommate or my person who lives near me. And now you move somewhere out there, now I need a vehicle. When I didn't need one before, right? And so that's $900, the average cost of a car to live in Portland. I mean, you got, you know, I do this person's hair, and in return, they, you know, we share food stamps or so much stuff that they do to be successful. Because once you live in an area with your community for long, you become like ingrained with that.
And emotional.
Oh,
like,
exactly.
The love, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And even if, and it's, you don't just impact the person who is moved out. But when you take a person out of that community that it's depended on, you impact the people who are still there. You know, like if I was to move her mom out, now she don't have somebody to get her kids from school, right? Now she don't have all of the benefits from that. So we realized that, because at the beginning we were like, we need to incentivize people to go to Green Pens. Like that was our original thesis. We were like, we're going to create all kinds of benefits of why you should go here. I don't care if we're giving away free vacuums or something. And then we were like, after doing that work, we were like, we cannot move them out. I mean, there are some people where they should not be successful. Like you're like, you work at 7-Eleven and you make $12 an hour and you work 30 hours a week, yet you are doing fine. How is this possible? Right. And it's because community is making up for literally more value than her actual employment. Right. And so when you remove a person from that and put them out into the middle of nowhere, it's over. Like even if they can pay rent because the pen was green, right? They make the minute, they make the multiplier, they qualify. They're going to be in poverty. Right. And the other piece, like you said, people just know what they want in property. And I gave a speech at OCF where I gave an example of a woman who literally didn't want a property because it had blue bedrooms.
Yeah. I mean, as you're saying this, I'm just reflecting on my own privilege of, you know, I grew up in Maryland right outside of DC, and I, you know, I moved 3,000 miles away and I'm super close with my family, super close. But financially, well, it was right after college, but, you know, had help financially going to college, all of that. And I can move way out, live with roommates, you know, got a good job, carpooled, stuff like that. But like, I just feel like there's such a difference in the haves and have nots of just the world getting so much smaller to where people can live wherever, like in, you know, Asia or whatever, but, and be so far away from their family and community. Don't really know how to, you know, the value, like then you're really lonely, you know? So then there's like, there's trade-offs to everything. And so I just think that like someone should measure the value of community because it's so important.
I that was one of the things that I was like, I wonder if you, if somebody could put together, because if you could find a way to like artificially like speed up, because communities take time to create, right? Like it's based on trust. It's based on you understanding my situation enough to figure out where you provide value and where I can provide value to you. And that's not an instant thing, right? We need to be neighbors. We need to see that your kids are, you know, standing outside for an hour for me to be like, I can just take yours home. You know, when like it's not something that you can just speed up. Like it just has to naturally occur. Right. And if there was a way to like artificially do that, you could be providing the value of thousands of dollars that didn't come from employment, right? It's like another issue for somebody else to figure out how to solve years down the road. Well, but it could be so awesome if somebody could do that.
I just think what you're doing, especially getting that key insight after you thought you already solved the problem, but then you didn't really, because people really need to be in their communities, and so you're now solving a new problem. I think, you know, what I'm learning as I get more engaged in the community is more of the historical macro thing that we've done in America, where basically in the 50s and 60s, we as citizens abdicated our responsibility from the community and pay the government more in taxes and say, like, for foster care and for all of these things. It's like, government, you take care of it. And we as citizens aren't going to do any of the messy work. But what happens is that we get emotionally isolated.
Yep.
And so, and, you know, Oregon's one of the most unchurched states and faith, you know, outside of Christianity, other faith communities are not as strong as, you know, across the country. And so we are becoming a more and more isolated, you know, just disconnected from the community. And I think people overvalue their own comfort and don't want to get into any messy stuff, but then they lose the connection to their families and the community and things like that. Yeah. And you're helping to reestablish that connection with just this.
Or preserve.
Yeah, preserve yeah. it with really the center of it all, which is a home, you know? Yep. And
foundation right yeah. there. And I will tell you, it's not bad people. The people who have the biggest hearts are still sometimes the privilege is blinding. I mean, I did the speech at OCF. I was greeted by the warmest people that were like,
which is the wealthiest crowd
exactly,
in Portland.
In
yeah.
Portland, right. And the first conversation that I had was like, you know, we need to figure out how to make sure that the right people get these support, these vouchers. And I was like, what do you mean? And the gentleman was like, all in good spirits.
Yeah, good intentions.
Yeah, good intentions. He was like, because the woman that you spoke about that didn't want to rent that apartment because it had blue bedrooms, I mean, he was like, that's ridiculous. Like, he was like, if it's blue bedrooms, like, you are homeless. Like, you need to be into a place. Like, you shouldn't basically have those type of, you shouldn't be making decisions off of what you want if you're in that scenario. And
dignity.
It is.
Everybody has the right to get what they want.
And it's so hard to try to communicate with it, because it's like, you can look at the guy and see he's like, I want to help you. Like, I want to be, how do I participate? But at the same time, I can't see past my own privilege. And you think to yourself, you're like, I can't talk to him in housing because it won't make sense. So then all I could say was, you know, imagine if you're a vegetarian, right? And you walk into this building, you are starving. And you're like, somebody, please get me some food. And I run over a plate of pork chop and meat and stuff. And I'm like, here you go. Are you going to be like, the person's like, I don't want this. Are you going to say, well, then you ain't hungry then. Because if you was hungry, you would have ate this food. You're not going to say that. You're going to say, oh, what do you want? Right? What do you want to eat? It's the same with housing. Housing is a very emotional decision. You can't be like, what, you don't want this place? Well, you ain't homeless there. You don't need a house. That's bull. Like, that's privilege. And if you can't see through that, past that lens, it's so hard for you to be effective in a solution. And that's one of the reasons it's so hard for me to find investors, because it's like the investors are like, you really have to have a clear lens to see it, or at least be willing to see through a clear lens. Because if not, you are going to be like, I'm helping people who don't need to be helped, right? People who can't help themselves, or all these other things that I hear that are terms that are people looking through cloudy lenses, right? So, but it's tough.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. You know, I'm a white guy, super privileged, starting a tech-based service company here 17 years ago, and I've had a lot of people help me along the way, including banks and all of the things. And I just wonder, what has been your experience as a black entrepreneur in Portland? And especially when you were first getting this off the ground, like what kind of obstacles did you have to overcome, and where did you get your first money from? How did that happen?
Well, I'm gonna be as raw as possible with you on this, okay? Because if somebody hears this, I want them to understand like the reality. It is extremely difficult to build a business from the ground up in Portland as a black entrepreneur. At least it was for me. I didn't have the education. I had a degree in fire science. That does not help you in any other field except for putting out fires, right? So I'm sitting here and I'm trying to build this business. And if it wasn't for Prosper Portland putting on the Startup PDX Challenge and having me win that competition, there would have been no platform for me to voice my idea. Like, that was just the first, and they intentionally were looking for minority people to hear from, to say, how would you solve this problem? And me pitching that on that platform was the only reason I was able to get any traction. And so they gave me some seed money, and they gave me access to white people. I mean, that's really what it is. Because when you are around other Black entrepreneurs, it's your access is the white people that look at you, that are interested in hearing what you have to develop. So when there was times where I was like, make an introduction, and you will introduce me, but you're like, you know, these are my white people, and I'm not sharing them with you because it's so hard to even find one. And I became that way at the beginning. I was introduced to John Mulrooney.
Other Black entrepreneurs were like, I'll introduce you to the white people outside of like my core circle.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Yes, because it's so tough to, like, if you have
find white people who care.
Yes, it is. That you can't stray. You learn. It's like a natural cause to be like, I can't share this person because they're already so dedicated into me. And if what you're doing is just as exciting or just as cool, there's not enough of them to go around that will actually hear what we have to talk about. And you don't say it like that, but that's what it is. And so you will. And I remember getting to a point where I met with John Mulrooney. He was like one of the first people that I was introduced to that gave a crap to hear what I was building. And he gave a crap before, like, I've met with him before I even won PDX Challenge. So, and then he happened to be the person that they had selected to be the mentor for me in the challenge. So he was now obligated through this contract with Prosper Portland to be my mentor. And I was even having a hard time introducing him to other people because it was like,
he's my John Mulrooney.
Exactly. It's like, there's not enough. There's only one guy.
John's going to love hearing this.
Hey, if I get rid of the one guy, then who else do I have, right? Like, it's like that. It's a thing. But at the end of the day, I still could not get, I built this prototype, and it was literally on our computer. Like, I had these people in India built it because we had the only amount of money we got from Starter PDX Challenge was enough to have somebody in India develop this prototype. And it was managed by me. So I was talking to them about what I wanted. So it was, I can only tell you how horrible of a finished product it was, but it worked. Like, it literally said green dot, red dot, or yellow dot for all of the properties. And that's all it, and green meant pass and red meant denied, you know, and that's, it was, and it still had 1,700 people pull background checks with this platform that I don't even know how they even made it to the end. It was like DOS, like it was so bad, but it still worked, right? Uh-huh. And because at the end of the day, you saw where you qualify, it was enough for people to force their way through this thing, right? And I had the mayor stand up and talk about how it was going to be such a good product and how we needed this in our city. I had all these, Prosper Portland stood there. And when it came time to raise capital, it was the driest well you can imagine. John Mulrooney introduced me to people. It was so early of a product. I had this product, and they were like, it's running on this computer right here. I'm like, yes, we can never turn this computer off. Because if it goes off, housing in Portland is gone. Right?
Don't breathe on this computer. Exactly. It is very sensitive.
And it was just this the system that I couldn't get funded. And Stephen Green, he had been a good friend of mine, and he basically was the one who was like, you know, have you tapped into the Black community? And I'm like, my Black community don't got no money. So I don't know what Black community you talking about. And he was like, man, there's all kinds of wealth in the Black community.
And he started Pitch Black.
Yes, he did.
The most connected guy in all of Portland. Yep.
He is. And yeah, he's like, there's all kinds of wealth in the, I mean, and Stephen Green was my guy from the beginning. Like, right when he's the one who told me to apply to start a PDX Challenge. Mm-hmm. So he's the one who said, man, I want you to see you here. Because I didn't even know about it until he told me. And so I ended up, because the thing about the white community is that the wealth is organized, right? The thing about the Black community is that there's wealth there, but there's no organization system. So you literally, if I'm pitching to 100 white wealthy people, it's in a single setting, it's in a room, it's organized.
Oregon Venture Fund.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I'm pitching to 100 Black wealthy people, it is at a dining room table, inside the living room, inside the house. It's an hour presentation. It's during dinner. It's at a barbecue. Like, it's all these random scenarios because there is no, like, organized money. And I raised, the thing is, like, it is so much easier for Black people to see value in other Black people. Like, it is, even today, even a week ago, I had said to Homer Williams, I was like, with one of my investors, I was like, I was like, man, look how far we got. Did you ever think we would get here? And he was like, you know, when I met with you, I just had an idea. You know, I was like, God, this kid is so rough around the edges. It's a long shot, but it's possible. And I had the same exact conversation with a woman named Cammie Ritchie, who wrote me my first six-figure check, $100,000. She was my very first investor. And I was like, you know, did you ever think we would get here? She was like, the moment I met you.
I mean, that's
the moment I met you.
That was my impression, is you've got something special. Like, you're, yeah. I would have thought Homer would have had something similar. I mean, he kind of did, right?
He did. He invested. He just... but, you know, Homer takes the long shots. These people didn't feel like it was a long shot.
Yeah, you're a safe bet.
Yeah, that's how they felt. And so we raised $600,000 off of 35 or so Black people in Portland. And it was, I don't think I've seen, man, another person who's ever done that before. An entire seed round off of the Black community in Portland. And I just went around and I met with probably 100 of them, and 35 of them invested. And they elevated the company to a place to where the platform got redesigned. It was called noatfee.com. It was on the AWS servers. It was developed by a local group, and it was enough to get the city of Portland to say, your site is competing with our site. And so can you please we're going to do an RFP so that we can get rid of housingconnections.org, our crappy website, and then we want you to power it. And so we were going to power housingconnections.org. And that's how we got in contact with, that's how we started working with government. Because we had always worked with government. Like, they were the first seed money, right? And so we did that, and then the checks started to come. It was a $500,000 contract, right? And then we powered Housing Connections. Actually, we decided to not name it that because we were like, who wants to use housingconnections.org? So we renamed it as One App, right? And it was the one site that you could go to and find a place with one application. Like, and so, and it just grew from there. So that's kind of how that whole story went.
Yeah. So just last two questions, because we're getting, man, time is just flying.
Let's do it.
Give the audience a sense of, like, the exciting place of where you are right now with Portland and Minneapolis. Just a quick snapshot. And then the last question I'm going to end on is a personal one, is one person alive today who inspires you and why?
So with the quick snapshot with the city of Portland, like I said, we did that partnership where we powered their platform, and they had access to our data, the data we shared. And so we worked together on putting together a synopsis of what the Portland market housing looks like. We knew exactly who were denied, why they were denied, in extreme detail because of OneApp's platform. And we came together to solve that problem, and we were going to get our sharpest brains together, and we were going to look at all these reasons for denial and come up with solutions. And that whole concept was cut short. When you work with government, they can't invest the right amount of time, the right amount of money, the resources, because they're always on some cycle that has nothing to do with solving the problem. The cycle is based on new elections and when something got to get proposed and all kinds of stuff that has nothing to do with me and I could care less about. So we kind of like start to bump heads. Then they launched a bunch of ordinances that passed, which basically these ordinances made every reason why people were being denied illegal. And then they called it a solution. Right.
Which pissed you off because then all the landlords were really upset with you because they thought you intentionally made their lives miserable.
Yes, they were like, now we can't effectively screen. And they knew that my mission was to make access to housing. And they thought I was part of this ploy to use this data to get the city to strip landlords of the ability to run their businesses. And that was absolutely not the case. And I was way too vocal about my participation because of my eagerness to solve this problem and just being included in the group that was going to be solving it. Like, I was never a part of that. And they're like, they looked at me as a professional. As like, we want you to be a part of it. We think we will have a better outcome if you participate. And so everything came with OneApp's data learnings and Tyrone Pool. And then next thing you know, what happened was absolutely everything I was against. And so it put me in a really bad one. We got sent to Better Business Bureau by landlords off some stupid stuff just because they were mad about that. And we didn't do anything wrong. It was just, it just went bad for a while. But we put together a new system now that we are hoping to counter all of the negative potential impacts so that way we can still create the access safely. And it's called Fair Beta. It's a too big of a conversation to have today, but we are going to be able to make it to where the same access is granted that the city was trying to accomplish by blowing the bar, without the risk, the potential risk of outcome, negative outcomes to landlords and tenants that could be created by lowering the bar to basically zero. So, and then the last question that you asked me was my, who do I look up to? I would have to say that the number one person I look up to today, his name is Mark Jackson, and he is my pastor, my mentor since I was in the fifth grade, and a really close friend of mine and my family. And the reason that I look up to him is because he, since the day we have met, has challenged me on every level of like my being, and has made sure that no matter what I experienced, I still remained who I am. And that is something that that no one else, like, I don't know what I would be in life if he wasn't connected to me. And so I'll give you an example. I was being praised by the amount of families that our software housed in 2018, at the beginning of 2019. And there were some people that were there that were like, God, you know, Tyrone is something special. You know, he's such an anomaly, you know, one out of a million type of like results. Right. And it was, when you're that person they're talking about, it makes you feel great. Cause you're like, I'm special. I am like one of a kind. Right. And he comes to me afterwards and he's like, when people say that, you need to check them. And I'm like, what do you mean? Because it's so easy to just get swallowed up by all of that positive enforcement. And then he's like, when they are saying that you're one of a kind, it's their way of subconsciously trying to tell themselves that there is no real value to dig deep into the Black community and minority community for solutions. This is a one-off. This is a one-of-a-kind, you know, random thing that came out of this community. But there's no real value there. This was just a one-of-a-kind scenario. And he's like, you know as well as I know that that's not the truth. And so, and he's like, and I know it might feel good to hear that, but what he needs me to do is when they say that, to say, yes, I, you know, some special, but I'm not an anomaly.
There's Dwayne Edwards.
Exactly.
And Stephen Green.
You should know him. Yeah. You should have names to throw out. You should be like, look at all the value here. And
Renee Alums, who's just one pitch black.
How many people are not even, that are brilliant, that are geniuses, that just haven't had the platform and opportunity? When they get done talking about you, they should be emphatically eager to go and find the next you, not believe that there are no more yous and you are one in a million, right? And that is what, and stuff like that keeps you humble. It keeps you, and he doesn't let me get away with nothing. And he sees things from an angle that I'm never looking at. Like, I'm never looking
it's powerful.
That. It
it's
is.
Powerful.
And he keeps me in check all the time. And that is my pastor, my mentor from childhood. I literally, I was part of a program called I Have a Dream Foundation when I was little. And he was the dream, he was the coordinator. He was the head person. And he was like, Tyrone, I knew that I was going to be mentoring you forever when we met. You were just that kind of kid, and he is literally, I mean, through my marriage, through my kids, through my, and through business especially, he has kept me grounded, because there has been times where it could have been easy to lose sight of who I am, who what I stand for, and he keeps me in that space. So I would have to say he is the person who he's the MVP in my life, right? So he's the person I value the most.
Love it, man. Well, thank you so much, Tyrone, for being on the show. This was a meaningful talk. I love it. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Cheers.